Okay, we're going to try this again this Sunday. We've got lots of people in India, so if everybody's patient with us all while we find our way through. We're even going to try to do four measurables today instead of three, so I think that'll be a plus if you were here last week. You give me the chant master, that was humorous. So we don't have to have a song and dance today, we actually have someone to lead. So Geshe-la is traveling right now. So one thing I don't know, I mean, there's many things I don't know. One little thing I don't know is someone here that's assigned to do the motivation. Okay, so we'll wing that one too. I might do a short one since we have a lot to do. Okay. Need a prayer book. Oh, let's do some prostrations. I forgot that last week.
This is just for our minds, so we're doing this. And only if it makes you comfortable.
Since we have a lot going on today, I think we'll just do, I'm not going to even do a long guided meditation because you're doing some in yours, right? Okay. So we'll just set our motivation by thinking something in our minds about why we're here. So we always want to set a motivation before we do something in anything in life. If you were working on a project or even eating a meal, we just think about why we're doing it before we start to do it. So you can just raise your own personal motivation for what got you out of bed, got you dressed, looking pretty sharp and coming here today, bringing your children, for whatever reason you're here. In the Mahayana tradition, we usually like to add a little juice to that. So we're here because most of us probably want to be happy. We want our minds to be better. We want to be kinder, more compassionate. So to add a little to that, we hope that because we do that, because we become more kind, more compassionate, then in turn we are more beneficial to people just because we've done it. So in fact, you've already started it. So by just sitting here right now, the world is already better. Before you leave, it's already changing in your own hearts and your own minds, because that's what it takes, change. Okay, turn to page 34 in the gold prayer books. In the white ones, I'm not quite sure, so you're on your own. You are looking for Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra. We'll do that three times. Te ata om mune mune maha munaye soha. Te ata om mune mune maha munaye soha. Te ata om mune mune maha munaye soha. And underneath we'll do the Medicine Buddha stanza. Bhagavan, with equal compassion for all, whose name when merely heard dispels the suffering of the lower realms, dispeller of disease and three poisons, I prostrate to Medicine Buddha lapis light. And seven mantras. Te ata om beckon say, maha beckon say, raja samugate soha. Te ata om beckon say, maha beckon say, raja samugate soha. Teyata Om, beckon, say, beckon, say, Maha, beckon, say, beckon, say, Raja Samugate Soha. Teyata Om, beckon, say, beckon, say, Maha, beckon, say, beckon, say, Raja Samugate Soha. Teyata Om, beckon, say, beckon, say, Maha, beckon, say, beckon, say, Raja Samugate Soha. Teyata Om, beckon, say, beckon, say, Maha, beckon, say, beckon, say, Raja Samugate Soha. Teyata Om, beckon, say, beckon, say, Maha, beckon, say, beckon, say, Raja Samugate Soha. For the four measurables this time, we're going to do one in English, but we're going to do it nice and slow per request of our leader today. So just taking it nice and slow, reading it in English together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. And we'll pause here for a second. Thinking of how we wish all sentient beings, not just some, but all, to have happiness and the causes. In line two, may all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. In line three, may all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. In line four, may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Okay, page 37 at the bottom. We'll do 8 chin-raising mantras and 7 green tara mantras. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So Ha. 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 Thank you. Now the children may go to their classes. And introducing Karen Edwards. She's going to lead us today in, what's the topic? Oh, there it is. Self-compassion.
How's that? Can you all hear me? Okay. Good morning. Nice to see you all this morning. I feel nervous. I've got a lot of notes, so I'm going to probably rely on these until I start to relax a little bit. But this topic, I was just, you know, as we were saying the four immeasurables, we wish these things for may all beings. And sometimes we forget that we're part of that, right? We're part of those beings. And so this is, we're going to explore some of these reasons why we sometimes forget to include ourselves in that great wish for compassion for all beings. So that's kind of why I wanted to take that, the four immeasurables a little slower today. So I was kind of casting about in preparing for this talk, And I knew I wanted to do something about compassion. And I started reading this book from Thubten Jinpa, A Fearless Heart. And I didn't get very far because I got to chapter 2 and I found this concept of self-compassion. And it just was really a compelling idea for me. This book recounts the process of developing this compassion cultivation training that's offered through Stanford. I think it was offered here. Did anybody take that? I think it was on a Sunday afternoon. Okay. So some of this is going to be related to the work that was done for that. So he was writing, and Thubten Jinpa was a longtime English translator for His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and was a monk himself, and now is kind of an academic and does a lot of amazing things to help bring compassion and happiness to the world. So he was writing that when they were pilot testing this compassion curriculum, they had self-compassion at the very beginning, and people really stumbled with that, and it was kind of an obstacle to move forward with developing greater compassion. And I really identified with that idea that, you know, I have found that it's a lot easier to think about sort of sending compassion out, right? Family, for all these circles of larger and larger influence, and not always so easy to bring it home, right? To think about compassion for myself. So I really identified with that that struggle, and I really wanted to understand this a little bit more, understand myself more, and I thought it was something valuable to bring to this community. So I present this as kind of spiritual friend to friend. Okay, this is going to be more of a secular presentation of this idea because it's rooted more in Western psychology and contemporary psychology. But I find that it's really, it's Dharma inspired and it connects really nicely with the teachings that we typically get here. So we're going to, you know, self-compassion can help us go after certain kinds of negative thoughts. And those are negative thoughts of like self-criticism and self-judgment and sort of how we regard ourselves. Okay, hold on. Let me find that. There we go. okay. So self-compassion is a term that was developed around 2003. And it's, as I said, it's rooted in contemporary psychology. And it was a psychologist named Kristen Neff who had her own experiences with Buddhist teachings and with meditation and with realizing she needed more of this in her life. So it came from a very experiential place and she brought it into psychology. She sort of wanted to understand it more. So it has been defined as approaching our own suffering with an attitude of understanding, kindness and acceptance, a gentle, caring, clear-seeing yet non-judgmental orientation towards our own suffering and needs. So it's really kind of this attitude we can bring to ourselves as we're going through difficult times, and that includes, you know, challenging times on the spiritual journey too, bringing this attitude of just a kind of turning towards kindness and bringing that to ourselves. So self-compassion adds, be kind to yourself in the midst of suffering. And I like this idea, this combining self-worth with humility, because those are kind of two hard things to get your mind around, right? And that came from this book, from Thubten Jinpa. And that's just, to me, really provocative. Like, we have to sort of value ourselves enough that we're worthy of this journey. We have the potential for enlightenment too. It's not just like all those other people out there get to be enlightened and I'm the one that's defective, right? So this stuff hits pretty deep. And I thought that's another reason why, let me just go for it. and, you know, be vulnerable, but also hopefully bring this to you and it's compelling in some way. So really simply, self-compassion is like treating yourself as you would a good friend. Okay? I see some nodding, right? Okay, so here I found this picture from an event. So this is Barry and Andre at a fundraising event a few years ago. So we're going to just do a short, it's not really a meditation, it's kind of a thought exercise, contemplative practice. Okay, so you just get comfortable in your sitting, however that is for you. And if you want to close your eyes, that's fine, or keep whatever's comfortable, keep your eyes open. Okay, so you're going to imagine a friend, a good friend, is going through a difficult experience. They're really struggling. You can see they're going through something pretty painful. It might be like getting a poor performance evaluation at work and they feel their job's in jeopardy. Or maybe a relationship is ending and they feel like it was their fault. Or they're experiencing like a health scare or something significantly changed in their health. So what would you say to offer some comfort? So think about the words you would choose, the tone of your voice, and the body language you might use to offer them some comfort at this time. So now I invite you to imagine yourself going through that same difficult experience. And what would you say to yourself? What kind of language do you use? What tone do you speak to yourself in? How would you talk to yourself when you're really struggling? So you can go ahead and open your eyes. And I invite you to briefly introduce yourself to your neighbor and talk about the difference. Okay, you don't need to use the exact words, share those exact words, but what were the differences you noticed and how you might talk to a good friend and talk to yourself? So just take a few minutes to... Oh, yeah. Let's do it up here. Sorry if that was loud. Oh, I know it. That looks really... Y'all, that looks pretty juicy. Excuse me. That looked pretty interesting from this perspective. Does anybody want to share any flavor of that? And of course, it's really what only you're comfortable with, right? Because this can get. Yeah, go ahead.
Who raised their hand? Oh. Yeah, you have to, because we're streaming.
Okay, so both of the instances I used were relationship issues, my buddy having a relationship issue, myself having a relationship issue. And what I found was that when it was my buddy, I was very compassionate and sympathetic and caring towards him. And when I put myself in the same situation, I yelled at myself and beat myself up, saying, what's the matter with you, you know?
Right.
So that was the two main differences, given the same situation, of how I would treat somebody else towards how I would treat myself.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, I said, buck up. That was really helpful. Mm-hmm. To myself, that was...
Yeah.
Buck up, girl.
It didn't like it.
When I thought about responding to a friend in a difficult job or a difficult relationship situation, it was really easy for me to think and respond, like, this must be really hard for you. I'm sorry you're going through this. This job has been really difficult for you for a long time. When I thought about myself, I heard, like, my mom's voice, like, what it would be like to tell my mom I'm going through this, and I heard her saying, like, well, you should have known better to take that kind of job, or you should have known better to blah, 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 blah. But then I thought, well, on her, I don't even need to listen to that anymore, so.
Thank you. Yeah, so those family of origin voices, they're pretty strong, right? Yeah, we'll take another one.
May I put a song? May I put a song?
A song?
Yeah.
Okay, go for it.
Okay.
What you thank you for sharing that. So for you, does that kind of like song comes into your head when you talk to yourself, like, it's all right, it's gonna be okay? Nice. Thank you for sharing that. Many of us find, though, that we may be kinder and gentler, more understanding, like more patience. I think to, like, more patience to hear the whole story with a friend than maybe taking that time with ourselves to kind of go those deeper layers of what's going on, because we want to move quick to solve the problem, call the insurance company, you know, go to the doctor, whatever it might be, right? So when we think about self-compassion. So when it was originally conceptualized by this theorist and psychologist Kristen Neff, people who rate highly in self-compassion demonstrate behaviors associated with these three things. Okay, so these, if you take away anything from today, I think thinking about these three concepts in applying them, this would be what I would hope you would take away. So she found that self-compassionate people had these three things. She developed a self-compassion scale, and it has, you know, reliability and validity. It's like a science thing, okay? It's not a back of a magazine kind of scale, although we don't read magazines anymore. But And it's been used in over 1,000 published scientific studies and used in many different cultures and contexts with different populations. So if you're interested in that self-compassion scale, it is available online, and I did take it, and I did find it was really helpful. It showed me some interesting things, so that's available to you. So self-kindness is the tendency to be caring and understanding of oneself rather than being harshly critical or judgmental, right? So we've already thought a little bit about that, of how we talk to ourselves, like, I'm not good enough, not having patience for ourselves, I screwed up again, I need to be perfect. I read a Harvard, it was in Harvard Business Review, this idea of self-compassion, like just this month. And this kind of self-judgment was described as spirals of defensiveness or self-flagellation, right? And these are things we do to ourselves. And what I found, like, it was really kind of hyper-activated for me, this sort of self-critical self-judgment, has been coming up because I'm in graduate school the last few years. And it was, like, very hard to get in, very competitive, very high standards for academic performance. And I was just constantly felt I was needing to measure up to a certain standard. And so I felt a lot that I had a lot of this activation of this negative internal voice. I even found some writing, you know, I do some journaling and, you know, on my laptop, lots of stuff on this laptop, about my lack of confidence about even, you know, being qualified to get into this program. And things I would never say to another person, I was writing them in a journal. So this, you know, this particular one is something I really need to work on. And just this process helped me improve in this. Learning about it helped me improve in it. I also, I'm an occupational therapy student. So I've been working, done about 6 months of clinical field work, working with people who have significant health issues and changes in their function, like losing skills to be able to take care of themselves, like using the bathroom and getting dressed. And I work with them on a therapeutic level and really find that this, you know, really critical, harsh talk comes up in dealing with difficulties like this. So I heard this repeatedly from the clients I worked with, like, I'm never going to get it, I can't do this, why is this so hard? So self-kindness would be treating yourself with care and understanding, actively soothing and comforting yourself. Okay? So the next concept is common humanity. And this refers to recognizing that all humans are imperfect, fail, make mistakes, right? This is something that we hear from Geshe-la a lot, right? Life has complications. He says this to us a lot, and that this is samsara, sort of what do we expect? But being able to frame all difficulties and painful experiences in light of our shared human experience. So when we're having that painful moment of self-doubt, you know, being able to not go so inward that we lose a sense of how other people are experiencing similar difficulties, the same difficulties. And even if we perceive that it looks like their life has no problems, that's just, you know, a perception from our side, right? We don't know what's going on for them. So I was thinking about this, and so the countering, the common humanity counters this sense of isolation. And I was thinking about one of the people I worked with this summer. And I was working at, it's like a health clinic and a day program for adults who are eligible for nursing home level care, like had a lot of needs, but were trying to remain in the community. So we would give them like lots of support in the home and in the day program. So clients would come, the transportation's provided, and they'd come and have this experience, social experience together during the day. And so one client I got pretty close to, she's in her mid-50s and experienced a pretty rare neurological condition in which she lost a significant amount of motor function and could no longer walk. So she needed to use a wheelchair and needed a lot of other support. And she was somebody who was like compassion itself. Like, she helped kids, and she just was this person who was so engaged in life. And then all that just stopped when she became ill. And I think it was painful in that it was, you know, she's in her 50s, and this is not happening to other people around her. So she felt extremely isolated and spent a lot of time alone. So when she came to our center, she looked around and, like, saw a lot of people using wheelchairs and walkers, people of her age with significant health challenges. And she said to me, there's other people like me. And it was this, like, breakthrough for her own healing that, like, I'm not alone in this. Other people are dealing with this, same kinds of challenges. And I really saw that, you know, that healing power in the being recognized and recognizing others. And I sort of thought that this concept is like, you know, humanity is your support group, right? we know the power of being with others who are sharing similar difficulties. And just imagining, wow, that's 7.5 billion people on Earth, right? That's our common humanity. And then the last idea is mindfulness versus over-identification. And so we also look a lot at mindfulness here. The clear seeing and non-judgmental acceptance of what's occurring in the present moment. So seeing things as they are and not adding another, you know, storyline to that. And mindfulness is it's kind of a meta-awareness. So you're not just feeling like an angry, like a negative emotion, but you're able to observe yourself. You know, so you sort of step back and you're able to observe yourself experiencing that emotion. So having that quality, which is something we work on a lot here, right? Sorry, very distracted. So bringing mindfulness to how we may be perceiving our inadequacies or imperfections, right? So bringing that, like, beginning to notice that we're having that self-talk about those things. And I think, too, like we touched on a little bit earlier, sometimes when difficult things happen, like somebody's ill or our child's having a hard time at school, we can just switch into that problem-solving mode, right? And it becomes all about action. And we're not really taking the time to acknowledge that how painful that might be, that we're watching our loved one suffering. And we have some pain and suffering, too, associated with that. So mindfulness is about, you know, trying to find that that pause to recognize those feelings we might be experiencing. And this idea of over-identification, that means like our sense of self is so wrapped up in our emotional reactions that it's just our reality. So it's kind of like when you go to a movie and you're like so engrossed in it, you forget where you are. You know, you're like, you're the movie. So this is what that idea of over-identification is like. You're so wrapped up in your story, you can't step back and sort of see what's happening. Okay. So this is another time we can kind of share with each other, if you're comfortable. So my question to you is, what are some messages in our culture, in our families, in the workplace that might contribute to these habits of being really hard on ourselves, not acknowledging our own pain and suffering, and feeling isolated from each other? This is more of a...
One-on-one?
Yeah, the whole group, I think. Thanks, Erin.
So, Karen, this is a little bit on the previous slide, but it deals with in terms of the over-identification versus mindfulness, and I haven't verified that this is 100% accurate in terms of the what I'm about to say about translation, but like in English, we would say, I am angry, and that's a strong identification, like that is who we have become. In a language such as Spanish, you would say, I have anger, right? That's the translation. And then in Tibetan, this is what I've heard, is that the translation is like, there is anger. So it's, you don't, it's not you, you don't have it. It's like, oh, there's anger, you know? Isn't that interesting? We can observe that. We are not completely identified with it. It's something that has arisen and that we can kind of have mindfulness, pay attention to it, see where it's coming from, and deal with it like that.
So language itself.
Yeah. That is, let's see if I can tie into your actual question. That is sort of our culture of how we speak in our culture to become kind of more hard on ourselves because we really over-identify like that.
Thank you.
Go ahead. I know, I mean, one thing in our culture is the rugged individual and the illusion that you make it on your own or you don't make it, and if you don't make it, it's a failing, you know. It's in it. Of course, it's an illusion. Everybody that made it has relied on the backs of so many others, but it's still put out there. So if I fail, it's not it's me individually and not me part of anything.
I think on TV, having all of the advertisements and the self-help shows, all of the programs on the houses and how they go in and fix these houses that are amazing, and if you don't have that kind of house, it's like, what's wrong with you?
So that, like, evaluating ourselves against this some sort of standard that's impossible. Oh, there's one in the back, Susie.
I think also conversely, a lot of times we isolate ourselves because we don't want to trouble others. We're convinced that they have it worse, or we don't want to be a burden to them. But oftentimes we need to remember to actually acknowledge, hey, I need help too, let's help each other, rather than isolating yourself and saying, you know, I'm not, I don't need the help because they need help more.
My dad always used to say, when we were driving, slowing down is a sign of weakness. And I kind of translate that into asking for help is a sign of weakness. Some personal failure that you have to ask someone else to get by.
Yeah, self-compassion is often, originally the first look at it is like it's a weakness, right?
Raise your hand.
Thank you.
That was exactly what I was going to say. So.
Oh, okay.
I was just going to mention at work, I was given this office like on the second floor of the building, but there's like no one else. It's like the nicest office, but there, it has windows, but there's like no one else around. And I'm just like, I know you're giving me this office, but I'd rather work downstairs in the middle of everybody, even if it's not as nice or it's a cubicle. But there's this thought that, but it's the nicest office, but but at the same time, you're isolated. And to me, that'd be worse than, you know, having the nice office, than not having a nice office.
So that it's valued, right? The space is valued when it's not maybe what you need or want.
I'm going to follow here on the whole song thing. I'm not going to play it. I just tell you about it. There's this song called The Best That I Can. And it's basically, I play it when I'm waking up and going, okay, how am I going to do this day? And I'm just doing the best I can. And I think we all are. And I think when you isolate, or particularly myself as well, you forget that, you know, that's all we're really doing. We're just all doing the best we can. And it's a very lovely thing to find safe people that you can just kind of go home. And you don't get that messaging again about, well, you're not
sucking it up or buck up or, you know,
mm-hmm.
you can just be yourself and exhale. And then mm-hmm. that lightens the load for all of us, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
At least for myself. So mm-hmm. I appreciate this topic.
Thank you.
I feel like in our culture, we've also adopted this.
Oh, hold on, sir. We have one comment over here.
Thank you.
It seems like...
Yeah. Oh, we got it. Okay.
In our culture, if you're going to ask for something because you may be perceived as weak,
mm-hmm.
it's only okay to ask for help when maybe you just need comfort or mm-hmm. company. And feeling isolated from each other, if you have to ask for something, it's only okay to ask for help when you really, really need it.
Right.
Don't ask for just company or comfort.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point of this sort of gradation of it. Yeah. Well, thank you. I think about, you know, we're competitive. It's a competitive society, right? Very individualistic. And we have families living apart, right, where kids and parents have had to split up for work reasons or other pursuits. So we have less cohesive family units. There's a lot of contributing factors for why we can feel isolated and focus so much on our individual achievement, right? So self-compassion is kind of a counter to that. And so just to be clear, and you guys have already brought up a lot of this, but self-compassion is not about self-pity, like extreme self-absorption, self-gratification or self-indulgence, like I'm compassionate to myself by overdoing it on treating myself with a favorite whatever, fill in the blank, nor is it beating ourselves up if we do that thing, right? The binge watching or eating or whatever it is that we might be doing to address some of our emotional pain. And it's a little different concept than self-esteem. So self-esteem is self-regard based on a self-evaluation in relative to other people's position. And so self-compassion is considered kind of a more stable trait if you have it, whereas self-esteem can be more context or situation dependent. It works for you sometimes, but not in every situation. And self-compassion is also not about letting go of responsibility or consequences of action. It actually enables stronger motivation to reach your goals and more commitment to goals even when there's failure. So that's kind of what the research is showing. But it makes sense, too. So this slide, I know this is all the stuff from the research. So why is it a compelling concept for health and well-being? So it's strongly linked with mental health. So people who have higher self-compassion have lower rates of depression, anxiety, and stress, and greater happiness, optimism, and life satisfaction. And this is very consistently shown in the research, and that's pretty compelling, right? If we want to reduce those things, in ourselves and in society, depression, anxiety, and stress, this is something that we could really work with, I think, on a much larger scale. It's a strong predictor of motivation. So when you have self-compassion, you have, you know, perceived greater confidence and less fear of failure. So you're more persistent with pursuing your goals and able to, you know, get back to reaching your goals because you're able to learn from your failure. And it's linked to health-promoting behaviors like sticking with an exercise program, eating well, recovering from eating disorders, and having a moderate alcohol use. So it's pretty powerful stuff if you're in public health, I would think. And finally, it's seen as a powerful source of coping and resilience in the face of life stressors, which is kind of what we've been talking about. So it's been studied with divorce, health crises, academic failure, negative social evaluation, trauma, combat exposure, and parenting in general, and parenting children with special needs. That people who have more self-compassion, or if they learn self-compassion, they have just more of a wellspring of resilience for handling those difficulties. Okay? And that's a quote. It's a modifiable trait, right? So that means we can improve it if we want to. And even with short interventions can produce relatively long-term results. So even like in some of the literature, like a short two-week intervention, there were still benefits 6 months and 12 months out. These pictures were all like photographs that I took that I kind of, when I was struggling with this presentation, I was sort of fooling around with the images, but I put a picture of the Buddha here because, you know, the idea that we can change is sort of a fundamental thing, right? So this is something that we can change. And I've been working on this, you know, reading this maybe 6 or 8 weeks, and it's just started, like, changing, right? So I'm writing my master's thesis, and I think in the past I was really, like, you know, crack the whip, like, really hard on myself with trying to produce. I got to write 1 page a day. I got to have 5 pages by the end of the week. You know, really, really hard, a very critical tone, because I thought that was what I needed to produce the work. And so while learning about this, I'm like, what if I just stop that? Like, maybe I don't actually need that really harsh, critical tone to produce, you know, what I need to produce for my program. So I just stopped it. And it was amazing. And I still produced the writing that I needed to get done. And just sort of gave myself that, like, kindness and that encouragement along the way. So I felt this was really a powerful tool. So just one last thought, and then we're going to do kind of a contemplative exercise working with these ideas. I really wanted to kind of get clear in my mind, is self-compassion kind of reifying the self? You know, how does this fit in with other teachings we get about the self, how the self exists? And I have that picture of sort of threading the needle, because I feel like we have to be really, you know, when we're learning Dharma terms and concepts and working with them, we got to be really clear about what we're talking about. Like Venerable Rabina is one teacher we have that is always really encouraging us to be clear about what concepts we're working with. I think how I sort of settled with it is, and I like this quote, and this is not a Dharma quote. It's from a secular source. But self-compassion is sort of a paradox, as it's not really about focusing on the self, but about considering oneself as one of the sentient beings among all others, towards which it is worthy to dedicate one's own energy to the avoidance of suffering and promotion of happiness. So it's kind of like we count, right? We're worthy too of this, of all these things we're wishing for others, right? And so that I can't give a better Dharma teaching on that, but just wanted you to know that I sort of thinking about that. Is that, I see nodding. Okay. Okay. So now we're going to do, yes, please, Robbie.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. You know, we do get a lot of teachings about non-self. And mm-hmm. We do get a lot of teachings about non-self, both mm-hmm. of ourselves and others. Mm-hmm. And we're told over and over again, if we approach those teachings correctly, mm-hmm. it makes us more compassionate.
not less mm-hmm. compassionate. So even if we have a sense of myself is not the solid, fixed thing mm-hmm. I thought it was, we can still have compassion for ourselves, and same dealing with others. Even though their self is not the way we think of it, we're still compassionate mm-hmm. for them. So I think that's an excellent point, and it's not mm-hmm. contradictory at all mm-hmm. to be self-compassionate, married with a sense of the self doesn't exist the way mm-hmm. we think it does.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they, like I said, they always say, the more we understand it, the more compassionate we become.
Mm-hmm.
And if we find ourselves becoming less compassionate, maybe we're a little bit off the path or something.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Robbie. So the next thing we'll look at is it's kind of a meditation, kind of a contemplative practice, and it's going to combine these three ideas, the three sort of concepts that are part of self-compassion. And it's something that you, I hope, could take with you. So I wanted to be able to give you some tools as part of this talk. So if some of the language is not working for you, like the word suffering, you can substitute or think of the word struggle. If the word kindness is an obstacle, maybe the word support or protect. So I think part of this is finding out what works for you and what's effective for you. So I think if you get in a, go ahead and get, find a comfortable position for sitting. And just take a few moments to adjust your posture and take a few breaths. So when you're ready, think of a situation in your life that is causing you stress, such as a health problem, or a relationship problem, work problem, or some other struggle. So choose a problem in the mild to moderate range, not a big problem. As we want to build the resource of self-compassion gradually. So just search around and find something that's causing you stress. And visualize the situation clearly in your mind's eye. What is the setting? Who is saying what to whom? What's happening, what might happen. So can you feel discomfort in your body as you bring this difficulty to mind? If not, choose a slightly more difficult problem. So now, try saying to yourself, this is a moment of suffering. So that's mindfulness. Perhaps other wording speaks to you better. Some other things you could say are, this hurts. Ouch. This is stressful. Mm-hmm. Now try saying to yourself, suffering is a part of life. So that's common humanity. Other words that might fit include, I'm not alone. Everyone experiences this, just like me. This is how it feels when people struggle in this way. And now, try saying to yourself, may I be kind to myself, or may I give myself what I need? Perhaps there are particular words of kindness and support that you need to hear right now in this difficult situation. Some options may be, may I accept myself as I am? May I begin to accept myself as I am? May I forgive myself? May I be strong? May I be patient? If you're having difficulty finding the right words, imagine that a dear friend or loved one is having the same problem as you. What would you say to this person? What simple message would you like to deliver to your friend heart to heart? Now see if you can offer the same message to yourself. So take a moment to reflect on how the experience of this exercise was for you. Did you notice anything after you evoked mindfulness with the first phrase, this is a moment of suffering? How about when you reminded yourself of your common humanity, or when you invited self-kindness? Sometimes it takes a bit of time to find language that works for you personally and feels authentic. Allow yourself to be a slow learner. Eventually, you will find the right words. So you can go ahead and open your eyes. So that's just one kind of short practice you can do in the moment throughout your day, and kind of thinking of those three areas of self-compassion. And so just reviewing that, holding your thoughts and emotions in mindful awareness, so becoming aware of that negative self-talk. Reminding yourself that encountering pain is part of a shared human experience. And exploring ways to reframe negative judgments with more kind, compassionate ones. So if you're up for it, we still have a little time. There was one other practice that I wanted to add. It's kind of another way to work with self-acceptance. And I just kind of added this at the last minute, so I'm going to share what I'm from this book, what Thubten Jinpa writes about. So he writes about how, you know, for a lot of people, the feeling of being totally accepted as we are, warts and all, is rare, maybe elusive. So we might have somebody in our life who accepts us as we are, a loved one or a mentor, a parent. But we can also find this sense of unconditional acceptance from our spiritual tradition. And so he writes that, you know, he finds the visualization of the Buddha of compassion with thousand arms and thousand eyes to tend to countless beings a very powerful source of comfort. And he writes, the only criterion I need to satisfy to be worthy of his care, concern, and compassion is that I am a sentient creature, nothing more. In fact, in Buddhism, one epithet for the Buddha means a loving friend even to a stranger, because his compassion is not contingent on any prior history of personal relationship, right? The simple fact of being is enough. So that is definitely available in our spiritual tradition. And so there was a psychiatrist who developed, kind of elaborating on this, a practice of developing a compassionate image. And so I wanted to share that with you because I think it's something that has been useful for me to have the idea of this compassionate image. For me, it's the deity Tara. And for some of you, it may be other manifestations of the Buddha or other people in your life. So the core of this is finding an image to which you can attribute qualities such as love, compassion, wisdom, trustworthiness, and so on. So first, kind of scan in your life for an image in which you feel that deep personal connection. It could be like a wise person, even a pet who gives you unconditional love. It could be something in nature where you feel you're just accepted totally. Okay? So this will be the image that you rely on, whatever works for you. And so the more readily we can call on it, the stronger our sense is that it's there for us. So we'll just do a short visualization with that, with whatever that being is for you. So we'll take a few deep breaths. So now bring to mind an image of compassion that represents for you love, caring, wisdom, and strength. So take a little while to let this thought of your compassion image permeate your mind. It's not necessary to have a literal visual image of a person in the photorealistic sense, but to have the felt sense of the person's presence. Now imagine that in the presence of this image, you feel completely yourself, nothing more, nothing less. There's no need for pretense. There's no need for you to try to be someone other than yourself. There's no judgment, no critical voice. Instead, what you find is simply acceptance, warmth, and tenderness. So dwell on this feeling of receiving unconditional acceptance. What does it feel like? Do you feel the slowing of your heart? A release of tension somewhere in your body? A sense of letting go? Retain this compassion image as you breathe. Then as you breathe in, visualize warm light rays emerging from your compassion image that touch all parts of your body. As these light rays touch you, imagine that they soothe you, ease your suffering, and give you strength and wisdom. So continue imagining light rays emitting from the image and touching you, inspiring feelings of safety, serenity, and total ease. So you can just gently open your eyes. So hopefully you found something in that as a touch point when you're dealing with some difficult emotions. So that's all I got. These were the sources I used. Oh. Thank you.
I found that to be really helpful. I hope everyone enjoyed that. There's some good takeaways from that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your effort. That's a lot of effort. So we have a few more exciting things coming, but let's start with our exciting prayers. On page 246, Master Shanti Davis, dedication. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. Timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain,
Until then, may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. And turn one page prior. Some long life prayers. For His Holiness the Dalai Lama on the left and top. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. And the bottom on the right side. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Awatari, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama, ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. And then over on the left again, for Lama Zopa Rinpoche, you who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Majunas victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And seven green Tara mantras for Geshe Gelug and Geshe Tsongkhapa's long and happy, healthy life. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So Ha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So Ha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So Ha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu So Ha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So Ha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So Ha. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re So Ha.